In reality, it's taken the federal government years to give lands to the native people. The regional corporations have given the money that have taken the money that Congress has given them and either invested it in high-risk ventures which did not pay off, or else the money was squandered. There's been only a selected few regionals that have been able to invest their money wisely and now are viable corporations. But as a shareholder, how am I going to benefit from other or different regional corporations other than my own who have become a viable corporation? How is it going to benefit me? Yes, I think that 1991 is coming up fast, but I don't think the natives should make hasty decisions. Hasty decisions are vague and not well thought out. We must approach 1991 cautiously. The proposals that were made at AFN are not solutions, I don't think. I pointed out that one resolution contradicted another when I was there. We must stay away from decisions such as this if we are to survive this era. We must put more trust in our young, educated people in order for all of us to benefit from their learning. I know that respect thy elders is important in our homes, but in the business community, I feel that it's something that we should probably get away from, since we're dealing with a lot of cutthroat and sly people. Therefore, we need a person who is knowledgeable enough to deal with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My name is Tanya Devlin, and I'm Athabascan Indian, and I live here in Anchorage. And although this is given to you, the message is to the federal government. Honorable Judge Berger, your quest for knowledge is very good. The impact of the public law numbered 92203, or otherwise known as the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, in my opinion, is what will break the camel's back. It did not start here. It started years ago. Our people were living and surviving just fine before any outside influence bullied their lifestyle and values upon us. Our people had their own set of values which were parallel to the Bible. There existed believers and non-believers back then. There were good and evil, good medicine and bad medicine. People had their choices. People were spiritual. They prayed and lived their lives with respect in all that they did in regards to life. They had lessons of life and spiritual ways. Their spiritual life was exercised every waking moment. The spirit was the core of one's existence. Keeping the spirit strong and healthy was full time. Keeping that spirit free meant the opposite of self-centered. It meant being of service to everyone around, directly and indirectly. Now comes outside ways. They come in four basic different areas. First, the social economic. People came in search of riches, furs, something to further their economic status at any cost. They also introduced their social activities, alcohol, debauchery. It would seem that these people were of extremes. When they drank, it was to excess. The people who came to develop the land were usually those of more or less the fringes of society, and in fact were usually the outer fringes. When they drank, they usually drank to a state of drunkenness rather than social drinking or under control. As a result, a native saw the excesses, and I feel perceived and practiced this as a part of their socialization to the white man. Second, government and politics. It certainly didn't exist as it does today. Government was for the people and by the people. People went their ways freely, whether it was good or bad. Elections weren't held. People earned their standings by their merit, whether it was as hunters or as healers or those who by their experience had a lot to share and teach. Your people didn't recognize this, just as they haven't recognized the special relationship with the land our people live by. Our people didn't own the land, but they had use of it. They had summer camps, winter camps, spring camps, and fall camps. These were respected, and when an area was known to become in need of replenishment, it was allowed to do so. Our people had recognition of their individual strengths or gifts. They were providers, messengers, the men's ways, women's ways, medicine people, all donating, sharing, and caring, giving for the good of the people. Then along comes your government and politics. At first, we were not recognized as human beings with rights, much less allowed to participate in decisions affecting our land, our future, and our life way. The idea of leaders being elected or given an office as a reward by other politicians is totally new. It is of great scorn even today to see so-called native leaders who, like ourselves, individuals reacting to which way the wind blows as being representative of the natives of Alaska in their thinking and ideas. The term leader implies followers. You lead, I follow. You assume you have knowledge of what is best for me and my children and coming generations, and I should depend on you and trust you and your judgment. Third, education. This whole new society began introducing itself piece by piece, contending that each piece was more important and all pieces were more valuable than what existed prior. The next logical step would be to educate the heathens to a whole new society. We learned ways that could sustain one in a whole in New York, in Chicago, Europe, history of itself, values of itself, ways of itself, careers, social, political. The Bureau of Indian Affairs tested and informed students of what the Bureau thought our students were best suited to become. For example, I was informed that I worked well with people, regardless if they're dead or alive. Another problem, in the excitement of educating all these natives, no one seemed to pay attention to the local job market. What skills would be in demand or where that demand existed wasn't taken into consideration. In fact, special funds were regularly incurred as incentives to displace trained natives to relocate outside. The vocational training did not apply to village life. If one, in fact, looked at what was being done, the only conclusion a person could come to is that a deliberate effort was in place to displace all of the natives and their whole culture, to assimilate them into a society by moving the young outside. Was that the seed of the 13th region? This thought of relocation was depicted in the movie Spirit of the Wind, where the young George Atla was living a natural life and then was forced to undergo an unnatural life because of his illness. He loses a valuable part of himself to find it later in dog mushing, but finds he now considers many aspects of native life unnatural. This also happened to the great majority of young natives who generally forced to go to schools outside or away from their home orientation just when they're in the most impressionable. People caught in this time warp are just starting to appreciate their culture, but many of them were lost along the way because they, like Atla, were lost and didn't know what it was they lost out on. The fourth is religion. The introduction of organized religion was basically a toss-up. The various denominations divided up the territory and started saving the natives. Little did they know the damage that would take place. Our people understood the Bible very well. our traditional life, understood very well the traditions of Christ's teaching, the signs of his time. This was foretold by our elders. The breakdown, I believe, was in the method of approach. You see, our traditional beliefs were applied to all we do. We prayed daily and believed very strongly in a great spirit. Our relationship with creation was very sacred. The animals were taken with utmost respect and a feeling of gratitude, not only to the animal, but more importantly to the Creator. Then comes organized religion. We did not have a free choice of denomination, nor did we realize there was such a wide selection of Christian faiths. Our spiritual life was directed away from home, into a building, to be outwardly practiced one day a week. The practice of our strong spiritual existence, individually, within our families, and in our community, slowly weakened and drained our spirit. We were told not to speak our language, not to dance our dances, nor to be ourselves. When you are told your ways are no good, what does that do to your self-worth and all that has been passed down through the generations? Is this a great deception? It took me years to find myself within, to restore my self-esteem, to revive my spirit to what it is today. I believe what Paul wrote to Timothy, "For God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." Now, taken into consideration, all of these four currents created a great struggle individually for the family and for the communities. Along comes the land claims. Our people were seeking an equitable settlement. We were not well equipped with knowledge of how to make laws. We were seeking justice. Unfortunately, oil had been discovered, and so it was critical to come to a settlement. Pressure from the oil industry justified expediency in our settlement. I choose to believe that the people who traveled to Washington, D.C. on our behalf did so with good intention. I choose to believe their action was distracted by money, power, and influence. The law, settled as it was a vehicle to end a trust relationship with an unfriendly government. The so-called leadership was not recognized by the people. It was recognized by the feds, by the press, and electronic media. We were not included in the decision-making process. We are told, "Don't worry about it, we'll handle it. You don't need to know about that." We have somewhat learned how corporations function, the stockholder responsibilities, the business of making a profit. Look at the method of conducting a meeting. We were advised to use Robert's Rules of Order. I don't think Robert would approve of how we twisted and abused his rules. We conduct the meeting before we get into the room. Then it is railroaded. What happened? It's the old enemy of me, myself, and I, and what can I get out of this? Greed has swept through many of the leaders. Do the feds listen to the people? No, they listen to the people who they recognize, the people who speak their language, who share their so-called values. Proxies are another abuse. Believe me, I know. I was a part of a great struggle. It was indeed a battle. In order to succeed, you need to take a long, hard look at the tools and how to achieve the goals once they are set. We knew what we did not want and what sought out the people with our point of view. Our struggle was to return our corporation to the people who reflected our values. That included keeping the good of our people in mind, the protection of the land, our heritage, and our generations to come. We abused the proxy, but it was done to offset the larger evil. Then, with respect and keeping with our values, we must not abuse the privilege if at all possible. The land claims divided us and forced us to look at our difference very negatively. Introduction of self-determination provided us with the legislation of taking care of ourselves. Again, the leadership was recognized not by our people. This law disguises itself as being a little closer to home. Yet even from the start, the titles of the leaders themselves bring to mind a little chuckle. The Indian Health Service department heads took up the titles branch chiefs, while the so-called native leaders became presidents. Tradition was instant. It became very convenient. Take on tradition when necessary, put it away when not needed. Tradition was not a life way, but more as a memory of what life used to be. Subsistence is another word which put a wedge among the people. The only people who even come close to an understanding, in my opinion, are the ones who have experienced being shipwrecked or who have lost their way and were forced to survive in a wilderness. And when they have returned, they come with a whole new outlook on life. They often refer to it as a spiritual awakening. In closing, I would like to share with you a passage from the Bible. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. And you shall keep my judgments and do them. And you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers. And you shall be my people, and I will be your God. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
You who would like to testify, we'll be taking a short break for lunch and we'll be returning at 2 o'clock. Please come back.
Yeah, thank you all very much. Hi. Just fine. How's yourself? Good. Sure. That's right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll start our hearing this afternoon, and I think those of you who were here this morning will agree that it was very worthwhile, and we'll just carry on this afternoon. I don't think I need to explain again why we're here. Simply welcome you all, and say that our first witness this afternoon is Judy Ramos, and I have some other names here, and we can just carry on. So, Judy, if you'd like to begin.
My name is Dachutsu or Judy Ramos. I'm a yech or a raven. I belong to the Tisk Owl House. I'm a daughter of a Klutnachati. My father's a Klutnachati. I'm a Genechon person. That means people of the copper digging clan. And why we call ourselves people of the copper digging clan is we originated from the Copper River couple hundred years ago. I don't know how many years go back, but we still carry the legends and the stories of our tribe migrating down from Chitna and settling in Yakutat. I'm a daughter of a granddaughter of Golden Eagle clan people. My grandfather was a Golden Eagle clan person. My ancestors, I trace also from Ketchikan to Chitna, but also I have Filipino ancestors in my background, and my great-great-great-grandfather was a gold miner, Bremner, who explored the Copper River with Lieutenant Allen. So I have extensive genealogy, which I'm very proud of, and I'm interested in the culture of my people. In that vein, I've got a bachelor's in anthropology, and I have the last semester to finish my master's in teaching in education, because I think the education of our people is very vital to the future of our people. I'd like to start out with some concepts that I developed when I was in Norway. I visited with the Sami Aboriginal people of Norway, and I was very amazed at some of the subtle discriminations that the Samis were facing, which our people were facing, especially in the area of education. We visited the Sami Teachers Training School, and I was amazed that the Samis weren't allowed to teach their own children, but instead they brought outsiders to teach their children. They brought they taught these outsiders Samis, which happened for many years here in Alaska. And some of the things that happened to their religion were they weren't allowed to practice their religion, and they were outlawed. And all their instruments, their drums, which were sacred to the shamans over there, were destroyed. And also that the healers and the other people had gone underground, even though they told us they didn't exist anymore, that we knew they existed, and they did come to us in spite of what they had told us, that those people did not exist anymore. So I got interested in indigenous people and what's happening around the world. And in my area of anthropology, I found this books called Victim of Progress, that we are victims of progress and that we are victims of the miracle. And there's some things in there that perhaps you've heard of before, but I'd like to repeat it. In many areas of the world, tribal systems are under pressure of governments to develop resources for the benefits of other nations. Professional developers, experts, develop elaborate programs to bring unwilling tribal peoples fully into the national economics and to promote social economic transformation. And this is called community development in most of the nations. And community development is part of a national plan, usually. Community development brings about modernization, promotes industrialization, and helps people to cope with the changes in modernization created. I've had some differences between the definition of modernization and the definition of westernization, because it's my view that we've been modernized but now westernized to views, and I think I'd like maybe people to comment to me on that, if you think we've been modernized or westernized. Community development helps people to deal with the sweeping changes throughout most of the world. And these are world sweeping changes going on in all countries, especially the third world countries that are being developed. And some of the changes that I thought was important was the movement of people into the cities, and also a spread of urban ways into rural areas. And this is happening especially here in Alaska. The change of the way people associate, and they change in the way they associate from custom, face-to-face relationships, and shared values to ones based on rules, regulations, contracts, and anonymity. I think that's real important, because I've seen that, because I've moved from a village to a larger city, finally to Anchorage. And changes in the family structures from the extended family system to the nuclear family system. The other thing I thought was important was the price that we are paying for this progress. The price of forcing progress has involved the death of millions of tribal peoples, as well as the loss of land, political sovereignty, and the rights to follow their own lifestyles. And this is, you know, carried out in all our legends of what happened to the tribes and the villages of Alaska because of smallpox sweeping the villages, and many other things happening, and alcoholism and suicide, and also the deposit of our elders into nursing homes. And the elderly in the nursing homes has been really an interest of me as of this last month. I've been going out to the nursing home here in Anchorage. There's 60 Native elderly in one nursing home here, and there's not a whole lot being done for them. They have maybe one potlatch for them once, twice a year, and that's all the contact these Native elderly have with their culture. And so as a result of this loss of contact, they're dying out. The other concern that I was really are doing a lot of research into is the effects of education on our people. Vine DeLaurie had some things to say that I would wanted to share with you. This problem with the education system was also reflected by Vine DeLaurie. But a whole new generation had grown up educated in mission and government schools. These young Indians rigorously rejected old religious activities as a continuation of paganism. Older Indians see the education system as basically godless, intending to destroy communities rather than creating them. This formalized systematic education system was seen by Indians as a primary tool for the implementation of culture change. Formal education held for Western man the key to civilized greatness through its training. Today, Indians are not willing to be part of this melting pot. They see an equal standard of living, but they don't desire his code of values. While they're looking to formal education as a solution to their problems, they don't want to assimilate his culture being. It was interesting for me to look at the different views the different missionaries and educators had. One was the one of the early commissioners of Indian Affairs. It was Crawford Hardy, and in his statement in 1838, he said the principal lever by which Indians are to be lifted out of their mirror of folly and vice is which they are sunk is education. Another was Commissioner Medhill in 1847 was, while tribes remain in their aboriginal or hunter state, there can be no just or adequate appreciation among them for the practice use of letters. Agriculture and the mechanical arts serve to awaken a new interest by teaching them the true relations they bear to each other. Missionaries took upon themselves the responsibility of bringing civilization and Christianity to Indian people. These missionaries divided the various parts of the country into different church sects and jurisdictions. Many of our older Native people had recognized these changes going on and how that's going to affect us as people. Louis Sartridge, he is one of the foremost earliest Native anthropologists, and he wrote an article called My Northland Revisited. He had been working on the East Coast, and he came back to Alaska in 1917 to revisit his people. And in 1970, these are some of the things he saw. He said, like many other Native tribes of America, the Tlingit people are wandering step by step away from their old customs and habits. Modern influences that are the causes of the heterogeneous changes in their lives are particularly noticeable at places where European migration is encouraged by the prospect of beginning a new life. Most of these Alaskan Indians are fascinated by the new ideas of these white people and casually adopt them. Only a few affectionately hold to the teaching of their forebears. And the effect of this change is noticeable as far as the native languages are being lost, especially in, where I'm coming from, the Southeast, that in 2015 there will be no more speakers of my language. There was several notable speeches before the Governor Brady in 1889, and one of these that I was really struck by was Chief Shuwakeka from Juneau, and I just wanted to share with you one statement that he said. He said, "The canoe rocks, and we do not know what will come of us. I have been in the dark, very dark now. Give me a light. This is what I ask of you now, so that I can see." And he was testifying along with the chiefs from all over Southeast that they had been losing their land, and that their rights have not, their rights to own the land wasn't being honored. Governor Brady's answer was to this. "I know that the Tlingits are better off today than they ever were before in their lives. I'm afraid that the Tlingits are entertaining wrong notions of how much land they own. The Indian cannot claim the whole district. The government does not for a moment recognize that all the ground is his," so that he's basically denying that the Tlingits owned all that land or had owned all that land. And also at the same time, there's a Frank Garcilas, and he said, "Governor Brady has always considered the Tlingit the equal of the white man if they are educated and cared for. We think the Tlingit almost equal to the white man, but if you do not want to be educated, we cannot help you. Now, if you want to take advantage and advance yourselves, all the officials and missionaries are willing to help you. You must decide for yourselves whether you are to be classified as Aborigines like the wild man of the West. But do not ask us afterwards what we should do. You should think for yourselves and decide whether you want to be American citizens or do you want to live in your old customs." So they had a choice at, you know, in this is sort of the 1898, whether you want to become citizens or Indians or Tlingits. So, you know, that, you know, started the formation of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and other organizations in that time. I wanted to end with two laments, or laments, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, that two people from my village have composed. And basically, they were laments, or songs of sorrow. And songs in my culture have always expressed how a people feel, how their deepest feelings are. To them, the music was an expression of their hopes, fears, love, and grief. Songs revealed one's ancestry and expressed their relationship to each other and their environment. Through studying their music and dance, you can better understand the Tlingit social system, art, and culture. One of the songs was by Annie Nelson Harry. Annie Nelson Harry was the last living full-blooded Yaak. It's a culture here in Alaska, Native culture here in Alaska, that is almost dead. She was the last living full-blooded Yaak that could speak her language. And she calls this a lament for the Yaak, because she was the last real living person of her culture, and expressed her sorrow and loneliness of being the last living Yaak. And I don't know, this somehow expresses to me a feeling of what we're losing in many ways when we lose our culture, Alaska Native culture. She says, "I just break out crying, all alone here I go around. Like ravens, I'll live alone. My aunts are dying out on me, and alone I'll be living. My uncles also have all died out on me. I am all alone. Some children survive with me on this earth. Where will I go next? Wherever will I go next? They are already all extinct. They have been wiped out. Maybe me, I wonder. Maybe our father wants it this way for me, that I should live alone. Alone, alone, alone. Here I walk the beach at low tide. I just break into tears. I sit on a rock. Only the Yaaks. The Yaaks, they're all dying off. Yes, why is it alone? Just I alone have survived." Another beautiful lament that I like was the Yaan Clan, the Great Land, by Olaf Abraham, my grandfather, which expressed or reflected extinction of a way of life. Here he introduces the lament. "To this our way of life unfolded, the Great Land it was called. Even as I am telling of it now, still it has not returned from this to the way it was, its legacy, and it will not return. This is our extinction. It is slowly that hunting on it has come to an end. From my saining, I look up into the great land valleys. This is his tribal land. And this is where my feelings always get like this. And this is the way I'm always thinking. And this, like a song, it happened in my mouth. And like this, the song happened in my mind. And now today, I will start singing the beginning of the song. I look among the great land valley mountains. I imagine you are there, my uncles. I look around for you, children of the Jishkwe Di clan. You gave me inner strength." So that's how I'd like to end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'd like to give my testimony following someone from Sitka. My name's Evelyn Hash-Pete.
By the way, before you start, Evelyn, Judy Ramos mentioned the book Victims of the Miracle. Sheldon Davis, who wrote the book, is coming to Anchorage to testify at the roundtable March 13th to 16th. I don't know if you're a student of his, but you're welcome to come. It'll be at the Rondi Palace, March 13th to 16th, an opportunity to meet him.
Okay,
sorry, go ahead. Evelyn Hash-Pete.
The special relationship between tribal governments is accentuated by respect, courtesy, and a bartering cultural potlatch of extending family. Our family continues forever. And only on those terms as passed on from family member to family member. This is religion. And every aspect of tribal life. Our family is huge, and the intertwined family relationships extend throughout Alaska, Soviet Union, Canada, Greenland, and of course includes the North and South American continents, Hawaii and the Philippines, to name a few, to name what I know. Especially in Alaska tribal laws, we are aware of previous, and this is before the invading colonists tried to settle in our land. We are aware of previous land transactions, bartering relationships, and tribal relationships, which have not changed and continue to exist as mandated by those tribal laws. And we still recognize all of those transactions that happened in the past, the ones that are happening now, and the one impossible bartering relationships that we might have with other indigenous original Alaska people. The Atnat Anna people, that it means the people of the river of the land, but the Atnat Anna extends from Selchaket, Ninana, Arctic Village, halfway between Tanna Cross and Black Rapids. Half of Paxson Lake belongs to Neltinen family, the Eagle Clan, and the other half belongs to the Chishu Clan, the Raven Clan. Beaver Creek in Canada, below Kluane Bina or Kluane Lake, the areas of Shoshana, Turaldina, Taskadina, Akadina, and Tasnuna to the south, or around the Chitna area. Brimner River, which is what Ms. Ramos was speaking of. Kinchina River, which is the Indian name for Tansina River. Kinchingaina is a little Tansina River. Tikal, Sitka, because we have relatives in Sitka. And from all the drainage area of the Copper River, and the claim made by John Billam the First, or Doc Billam, in 1920, and the claim made by John Billam in 1956 to the Indian Claim Commission, which said that he named off most of these rivers that I said, but all the drainage areas of the Copper River and the Chitna River. Continuing to the tributary which flows from the Matanuska Glacier below Gunsight Mountain, I don't know the name of that, to all drainage areas relating to Tyone Lake, Ewan Lake, and Bindeltina, which is Mindeltna, Kinnick, Old Kinnick, Chickaloon, and all of the land within the tribal boundaries of each of the villages of the Atnat Anna, and the native village of Yakutat, which we bought and paid for with copper from Chitna. These lands are settled by our people as occupied, hunted, fished, traveled, bought, mined, used, and owned by the Djialchinen, Dukaidiyu, Neltinen, Chishu, Nechishu, Athchatne, Tolchinen, Yudishu, Athchishu, I'm trying to read my writing. And this was told to me by my elders of Chitna, Kludika, elders from Yakutat, Chitikulanda, Kinchina, Mintasta, and duly documented into the Atna language, Atnat Anna language, and stories. And there have been some documented on paper listing a few of these transactions. But so our travels are wide and big. And this is only one branch of my family, which is Indian, and the other branch of my family, which is Inupiaq. And from a child, I knew where we came from, because my great-grandfather made sure that I knew And my great-grandmother made sure that I knew what tribe and what clan I belonged to. And my grandfather, who was married to my grandmother, Walya Hobson, Frank Hobson, never let me forget that I was Inupiaq. So we have, just from one family and one aspect, a small family of 900 first, second, and third cousins, which is my family, have a history that has been here since time began. And as I said, we've seen two ice ages. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Mallott. Richard Mallott. Well, it says, yes, sir.
Sometimes I don't like my name either. My name is Ronald Mallott, shareholder of the Yakutat Kwan from Yakutat and Sea Alaska Corporation. And I pulled out the wrong papers. I have a prepared statement. I have a tendency to talk a lot, so I thought I'd do it in writing, minimize the time I spend in front of you here. Brought this along, I thought you might be able to be interested in reading it. I'll ask for its return. That's a article I wrote for the Tundra Times that was placed in the editorial column back in the 80s. Statement reads, I, Ronald Mallott, a Tlingit Indian of the Eagle Clan from Yakutat, respectfully appear before and humbly address the Alaska Native Review Commission on the effects of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, with hopes your attention and responses will be more favorable than those of other Native groups supposedly addressing the same concerns. As an Alaska Native and registered owner of 100 shares in both a village and regional corporation, and as a student of business management, I have a continuing concern that the lands awarded under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to enhance the development and growth of both the village and regional corporations, that without land transfer in total to provide corporate foundation, the corporations could not fully nor completely develop, grow, or prosper. To circumvent the needless attempt of natives to create corporate structures without proper foundation, the total transfer of lands awarded pursuant to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I drafted a legal approach to solution which called for the state of Alaska and the native corporations established by ANSCA to jointly select lands pursuant to the Alaska Statehood Act and ANSCA, and following agreeable selection, submit same as a petition to Congress for redress of grievance. Such an approach would greatly resolve or reduce many of the D2 land issues, while at the same time remove obstacles provided by imposition of the Antiquities Act, which operates as a restraint prohibited by the Savings Clause of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The object of the joint filing of a petition for redress of grievance was to compel Congress to reveal the purpose and intent of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act Savings Clause, and thereafter to execute all terms and conditions, including land transfer, accordingly. On March 5th, 1980, I submitted this proposal to Governor Jay Hammond, U.S. Senators Mike Gravel and Ted Stevens, and Congressman Don Young, and the AFN Incorporated Board of Directors. On March 13th, 1980, Governor Hammond responded favorably and suggested his chief legal advisors were awaiting a nod of approval from AFN, since it was to be a unified approach to the solution of a land problem adversely affecting both state and corporate structures within the state. U.S. Senators Mike Gravel and Ted Stevens both responded in effect that while the possibility of a conflict of interest might limit their active involvement, they could provide watchful eyes to assure proper and prompt action on the petition and guard against unnecessary delay. Congressman Don Young and the Alaska Federation of Natives failed to respond, failed to act for or against, even though the constitutional right to petition Congress for redress of grievance has been used twice in the Constitution's history, both times by Indian tribes or groups, both times successfully. The constitutional right to petition Congress for redress of grievance must now, not next year, be totally examined as a possible proper course of legal action to resolve the land dispute and to place a Native corporate structure on a land-based foundation for financial development and growth. It's amazing I'm able to read this without my glasses.
Should have said that.
Without total land award ownership before 1991, the cash value of corporate stocks will remain almost valueless, considering the potential value increase when land awards become finalized. This, of course, means that natives must sell their stock in 1991 or prior to a total land transfer will not only lose their land,